to present the keynote speaker of this dinner. We're honored to have him on our campus and honored to have him appear on this program. I'm sure that most of you are well acquainted with his distinguished career, and so I'm not going to try to tell you all about him. That would take a long time, even if I knew it all. He was born in New York City, received his bachelor's degree from Oberlin College, his doctorate in medicine at Harvard, and as a psychiatrist, he has served many years at Harvard, where he is now professor of psychiatry in the medical school as well as in Cambridge Hospital. During the course of his very full and very successful professional career, he found time to become a captain in the United States Air Force. He's received many honors, published a number of books, some of which are listed in our program for this event, and also many articles in scholarly journals. It is certainly most fortunate that he found the time to write his book, A Prince of Our Disorder, The Life of T.E. Lawrence. This great book received the Pulitzer Prize in biography. To speak to us tonight on Lawrence's vision for the Middle East, how does it look now? I'm happy to present Dr. John Edward Mack.
Thank you, Dr. White, for that wonderful introduction. I also wanted to thank Dr. Norval Young and Ed Metcalf and Claudia Slayton, and I better stop there before I get out of my depth, and Helen Young, who's my wonderful hostess, for the just extraordinary hospitality that I've experienced on this campus. I'm very grateful. In this talk tonight, I'm going to be quite personal. The subject of T.E. Lawrence brings, as those of us who have been taking part in the conference so far know, brings up a lot of differences of opinion and personal subjectivities, but when you try to relate Lawrence to the contemporary political situation and raise questions or make comments about that, our personal political selves become involved and we compound the subjectivity. So this is a kind of a forewarning to myself in part as well as to you that I'm going to be talking about things about which reasonable people can differ and even sometimes differ unreasonably. The map over there, I know you can't see it. Doesn't matter. I just want to point out that the events of World War I about which we're concerned have to do with Arabia itself, which is not shown here, but the that just was at the beginning. Don't worry about that. And the British campaign that concerns us here, Lawrence was involved in, moved up this way into Jordan, Palestine, eventually to Syria, to Damascus. So it was all along this part of the eastern shore of the Mediterranean. The Middle East that will be mentioned is this whole vast area, but much of my talk is going to concentrate on, particularly on Palestine and the situation in Palestine. Those of you that are interested to kind of refresh your memory about the Middle East can come up afterwards and see where each of the areas that I mentioned are. The map also has charted in different colored crayons, which I did while I was doing this research, Lawrence's travels in 1909, 1911, 1912, 1913, 1914 through the Middle East, which I was trying to figure out all the places he was, and I could visualize it best on this map, but that's not what I'm going to be talking about tonight. Now, when we think about Lawrence and his enduring fame and what drew me and others to him, we think about what he accomplished as a military leader, his contribution to guerrilla warfare and to military strategy, to the political settlements after World War I,
he had to offer in the way of shifting concepts of imperialism. But we also think of his vision of possibilities for the Middle East and perhaps for other dimensions of relationships between ethno-national groups. And it's this vision that he had for the Middle East that I want to think about with you tonight. And then look at what the present situation is in relation to that vision, and some thoughts about what we might or what might be done to perhaps bring things a little bit closer in line with that vision. Now, what was Lawrence's vision for the Middle East? What did he prophesize? I'll start by distinguishing the region as a whole from the specific question of the region that was called Palestine up until, and still is to some, up until the end of the World War I. First, consider what he said about hegemony in the region, leadership. And much of these ideas come from an article in 1920 in a publication called The Round Table, an article called The Changing East, which he published anonymously. In that article, he predicted a network of states that would remain after World War I, loosely tied to Britain, a new sort of imperialism. "We have to demand," he wrote, "of the Arab states, provision for their own defense. This is the first stage towards self-respect in peoples. They must find their own troops to replace our armies of occupation, which we are going to withdraw. For this, they must be armed and must learn by having arms not to misuse them. We can only teach them how by forcing them to try while we stand by and give advice." A very different notion of imperialism than what had prevailed up until that time. In 1928, he wrote, "I think there is a great future for the British Empire as a voluntary association." He predicted the importance of what he called the Bolshevik success as, quote, "a potent example to the East of the overthrow of an ancient government." But he failed to anticipate the demise of the British Empire and the rise of American power in the region as a result of World War II, which was still quite a number of years away. Consequently, he failed to foresee the degree to which geopolitical conflict and the superpower rivalry under the shadow of nuclear weapons would dominate the region at the expense of the human beings who live there. In terms of regional boundaries and leadership, he correctly foresaw the restoration of Turkey under Mustafa Kemal, known as Ataturk, within Anatolia. But he wrongly predicted that Baghdad, Iraq, because it was richer and bigger than Syria, would be the, quote, ultimate regent in the region. He predicted that Egypt would dominate North Africa, and Persia, he thought, Iran, would be united and unfriendly, or dismembered and fought over. He surely didn't foresee the Khomeini revolution. He understood that the continued momentum toward importing Western ideas and modern technology would be the rule in the region. "The disease of civilization," he wrote, "is physical, material, moral, and mental. The inevitable effect of too close contact with the West. Europe," he said, "evolved machinery over the centuries of struggle, quote, from pack horses to aeroplanes, but what of Asia, which has stepped in a lifetime of 30 years from saddle donkeys to Rolls-Royce cars, from blood mares to aeroplanes? Europe is not a thing easily digested," he wrote. If we extrapolate to what we have now in terms of communication systems, high-speed aeroplanes, and intercontinental and regional ballistic missiles, we can see that the technological momentum has progressed even more rapidly than he predicted. He failed to foresee the fundamentalist religious reaction in the region to the trends of modernization. He rightly saw that, quote, "we may be passing into an economic stage in which wars and governments will be mainly businesses. The economic motive may yet rank," he said, with religion and nationality in destructiveness. He did not see the extent of Western domination to satisfy oil appetites, and he certainly couldn't have predicted the willingness of the world's governments to permit private arms salesmen to supply weaponry with which rival Islamic groups could murder each other, and he would have been appalled to see the great power governments themselves supply arms in such quantities to all sides. He was most prescient in foreseeing the rise of nationalism and the drive for political self-determination in the region. "Merit is no qualification for freedom," he wrote in a British weekly in 1920. His own efforts may have been a force in stimulating Arab nationalism. Nationality, he said, was replacing religion as, quote, the modern creed, the new ideal, for which the Muslim would, quote, accept death gladly in battle. With himself in mind, perhaps, and his backing of the Sharif of Mecca in the revolt, he declared the desert to be, quote, the reservoir of all ideas. "Arab movements begin in the desert," he said, "and usually travel up the shortest way into Syria. For this reason, this present Arab movement, the craving for national independence and self-government, was started in the desert." Modern scholars of Arab nationalism, and both in this country, where they believe that Lawrence is misleading in this respect, and also among the Arabs themselves, resent his romanticization of the nomadic desert Arab, the Bedouin, and his disdain for the settled Arabs of the towns where Arab nationalism really developed. He failed to foresee the proliferation of new ethno-national and confessional groups in conflict: Sunni, Shiite, and rival Shiite, Druze, each armed by the cynical profiteers who feed off such conflicts. Turning to Palestine itself, the question is even more complex. Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, southern Syria is the region where the war was fought. Lawrence fought for British policy and also for the Arabs in the region. He tried to reconcile the interests of both, but he was also committed to the Zionist movement. In 1919, he drafted a letter for Faisal in preparation for a meeting with Felix Frankfurter, the American representative of the Zionist movement. In this letter, Faisal, speaking for the Arabs, wished, quote, the Jews a hearty welcome home, and asserted, quote, our two movements complete one another, and there is room in Syria for both of us. Hardly what came to follow afterwards. In the Changing East, Lawrence wrote of what he called the Jewish experiment as, quote, a conscious effort on the part of the least European people in Europe to make head against the drift of the ages and return once more to the Orient from which they came. They proposed to settle down amongst the existing Arabic-speaking population of the country, a people of kindred origin, but far different social condition. They hoped to adjust their mode of life to the climate of Palestine and by the exercise of their skill and capital to make it as highly organized as a European state. The success of their scheme will involve inevitably the raising of the present Arab population to their own material level, only a little after themselves in point of time, and the consequences might be of the highest importance for the future of the Arab world. It might well prove a source of technical supply, rendering them independent of industrial Europe, and in that case, the new confederation might become a formidable element of world power. However, such a contingency will not be for the first or even for the second generation, but it must be borne in mind in any laying out of foundations of empire in Western Asia. Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel, wrote in 1936 of Lawrence's belief in the Zionist effort. His faith, Weizmann wrote, in the Jewish national home grew correspondingly with the growth and development of Palestine as a result of Jewish efforts. In the winter of 1921, I had a long talk with him, our conversation turning mainly on Jewish-Arab cooperation. He regarded such cooperation as of the utmost importance, from the Jewish point of view, but equally in the interests of the Arabs. He thought that the Jews acted as a ferment and were likely to be instrumental in bringing out the latent energies of the Arab people. He thought that Arab redemption was likely to come about through Jewish redemption. Lawrence certainly understood both sides, if anyone can be said to have done so. And he did his utmost to interpret the spirit of one people and to explain the aspirations of the other, believing that close cooperation between the two peoples was to their mutual advantage. End quote. Arnold Lawrence, writing in T. Lawrence by his friends, felt that his brother would have accepted the increase of immigration from Europe as a result of Nazi oppression, but that was still in the late 30s. Professor Stephen Tabachnik, in 1984, in his book The Lawrence Puzzle, wrote that Lawrence, unlike the pro-Arab Gertrude Bell or the pro-Zionist Richard Meinertshagen, was one of the few and one of the last people in his own time and ours to achieve true sympathy for both national movements. He actually believed that they could be reconciled. And although subsequent events have seemed to prove him wrong, at least to date, this belief only redounds to his credit. Let us now turn to those subsequent events. Neither Lawrence nor Weizmann anticipated World War II, at least not at that time that Weizmann was writing, and the Holocaust and the overwhelming pressure of immigration and for the creation of a Jewish state and the subsequent seemingly irreconcilable clash of nationalities between the Jews and Arabs of Palestine. A national public radio program 2 days ago, in commemoration of 40 years since the establishment of the State of Israel, on this program, the announcer said, "These events fulfilled one people's dream for a homeland and shattered another's." Again, Lawrence didn't anticipate the degree to which the region would be caught in the geopolitical maelstrom of superpower rivalries, or the coming together of U.S. strategic interests, American Jewish support for Israel, and the domestic political power of the American Jewish community to tilt American policy in the direction of Israel in the Arab-Israeli conflict. The present situation is very grim indeed. In response to uprisings of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, themselves the result of the suppression of Palestinian Arab identity and national aspirations, the Israeli government has instructed its security forces to use force, might, and beatings. A medical fact-finding mission by Physicians for Human Rights, a group of which I'm on the advisory board, has documented thousands of deliberately inflicted limb, body, and head injuries. The report concluded, "Serious and potentially long-lasting psychological damage may ensue for many segments of the Palestinian population, especially to children and adolescents, and for the Israeli population, especially the soldiers. The consequences of the present violence may well affect a whole generation and thereby further constrict the possibilities of peaceful resolution in the future. As injury and death become routine, there is a steady erosion of the basic principles that all human life should be protected and that Palestinian and Israeli lives are equally precious. We observed an accumulating burden of rage and mutual dehumanization in response to the unremitting toll of bloodshed. Impulses for revenge lead to further escalation. Violations of medical and human rights are increasing as both sides become habituated to violence and complex political conflicts are reduced to a daily body count. Both groups, Israelis and Palestinians, find themselves locked in a struggle in which each feels that their ultimate survival is at stake. It is a conflict of two victimized peoples. Among Israelis, there is the perception of being vastly outnumbered, confronted by hostile neighbors, committed to their destruction. And for some, this uprising of young Palestinians is just a first stage to be followed by attacks by Arabs and eventually destruction of their people, and a fear that the West would stand by again as their country was destroyed. Palestinians experience themselves as victims of a brutal, unjust, prolonged occupation. They feel dehumanized, as do many other Arab groups, by Israel with the backing of the United States and its Western allies, which has taken their land and homes and would destroy their sense of community, if not their entire population. The Arab world as a whole is divided, and support for the Palestinians is uneven. But the Arab world is united in its view that no peace can come in the region until the longing for self-determination of Palestinian Arabs is realized and their national aspirations fulfilled. It is indeed a discouraging picture, but we can see directions from which solutions must come. It is here that Lawrence's vision of the central importance of reconciling conflicting national aspirations becomes relevant, his odd ability to see differing perspectives, all sides of issues. I would go further and stress the special example of Lawrence's exaggerated personal assumption of responsibility. We know how in the revolt he settled feuds in order that the tribes would not turn against each other. His writings are filled with "I promise this," and "my betrayal of the Arabs," when he had no license to promise anybody anything, and it wasn't his show to betray anyone. And yet he recognized the egoism of this exaggerated assumption of responsibility. In Seven Pillars of Wisdom he wrote, "The self-immolated victim took for his own the rare gift of sacrifice, and no pride and few pleasures in the world were so joyful, so rich as this choosing voluntarily another's evil to perfect the self. There was a hidden selfishness in it, as in all perfections." At the same time, he had a reverence for the sanctity of human life. Also in Seven Pillars, he wrote, "To man rational, wars of nationality were as much a cheat as religious wars, and nothing was worth fighting for, nor could fighting, the act of fighting, hold any meed of intrinsic value. Life was so deliberately private that no circumstances could justify one man in laying violent hands upon another." Let us look again at the messages in Anwar Sadat's visit to the Knesset and his speech there. For this is the preeminent example of extraordinary self-responsibility in the Middle East conflict in our time. Consider some of the things that Sadat actually said. These are from his Knesset speech, these quotes. "No one could have ever conceived that the president of the biggest Arab state, which bears the heaviest burden and the main responsibility pertaining to the cause of war and peace in the Middle East, should declare his readiness to go to the land of the adversary while we were still in a state of war." Next. "The obligation of responsibility before God and before the people make it incumbent upon me that I should go to the far corners of the world, even to Jerusalem, to address members of the Knesset and acquaint them with all the facts surging in me. Then I would let you decide for yourselves. And I must sincerely declare before you that I have the same feelings and bear the same responsibility towards all and every man on earth, and certainly toward the Israeli people. To avoid an inevitable disaster that will befall us, you and the whole world, there is no alternative to the establishment of permanent peace based on justice, peace that is not swayed by suspicion or jeopardized by ill intentions. And in all sincerity, I tell you, we welcome you among us with full security and safety. This in itself is a tremendous turning point, one of the landmarks of a decisive historical change. We used to reject you. We had our reasons and our fears, yes. We refused to meet with you anywhere, yes. Yet today I tell you, and I declare it to the whole world, that we accept to live with you in permanent peace based on justice. And finally, it was a wall that warned us of extermination and annihilation if we tried to use our legitimate rights to liberate the occupied territories. Together we have to admit that that wall fell and collapsed in 1973. Yet there remains another wall. This wall constitutes a psychological barrier between us, a barrier of suspicion, a barrier of rejection, a barrier of fear, of deception, a barrier of hallucination without any action, deed, or decision, a barrier of distorted and eroded interpretation of every event and statement. It is this psychological barrier which I described in official statements as constituting 70% of the whole problem. We need to pay attention not only to the repeated use of the word responsibility in this remarkable document, but also to Sadat's emphasis on justice and security, on acceptance and acknowledgement, on the interconnection of all peoples, and on the recognition of fear, suspicion, and other psychological dimensions of the conflict. It is not always possible for a head of state to act as Sadat did. Joseph Monfils, chief of research of the Foreign Service Institute of the State Department, has introduced the term track two diplomacy. By track two diplomacy, Sadat means what people who are not the official heads of government can do in terms of establishing relationships. The heads of government are sometimes locked into certain tribal patterns of showing toughness and strength and making official statements and cannot acknowledge as much. But people who are people like doctors or people who are professionals or people who are have some influence in the corporate world can sometimes establish relationships between countries that have a diplomatic power and set a precedent that the official leaders can't do. I would describe Lawrence as a kind of track one and a half individual. He was both official and unofficial in what he did. The Anglican clergyman John Austin Baker in 1979 gave a marvelous example of track two diplomacy. He acknowledged in Westminster Abbey, this high-ranking establishment Anglican clergyman, the historic sin of the British against the Irish people. And then, as Bishop of Salisbury, he was invited to the Cathedral of St. Patrick in Belfast, the first Protestant to speak there. There he acknowledged British atrocities and the neglect of Ireland. Our methods, he said, quote, had no moral foundations. You can imagine the impact that this had in Ireland. Joseph Monfils himself is one of the foremost students of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and he is unique in the United States government for his stress upon the need for acknowledgement of mutual national hurts, victimization, fears, and insecurity of both sides in the Arab-Israeli conflict. In a soon-to-be-published article, Monfils wrote, "To reverse the dehumanization process requires that Israelis and Palestinians, preferably with the help of third parties, breach the wall standing between them created by their tragic experience and reinforced by the dynamics of victimhood. Each people will have to teach the other that they are worthy and valuable as a people, sharing the universal desire for security, identity, and respect, and capable of recognizing and respecting this right in the other." But Monfils did something more. To illustrate and demonstrate the responsibility of all of us track two diplomats, he concluded a plenary address to the American Psychoanalytic Association by reviewing the unprecedented history of Christian oppression of Jews, and then he symbolically asked forgiveness as a private individual Christian of the Jewish people for the hurts inflicted on them by Christendom. He asked to be allowed to mourn Jewish losses with Jews and to, quote, work in brotherly alliance with Jews and Arabs to mourn unjust hurts suffered by some Arabs as Jews fleeing the brutality in Europe established a homeland in Palestine and ultimately the State of Israel. And he asked to work with Jews and Arabs to establish a relationship which assures a secure and just future for them and their children. But what of us, Jews and Christians in the West? What of me, an American Jew, a physician, a citizen of the power that is perhaps dominant in the Middle East region, if not in the world, the richest country on earth? What can I do? What can we do? It would be presumptuous of me to apologize, to ask forgiveness as Sadat, Baker, and Monfils have done. But something of this sort is needed. In the fall of 1979, the Iranian militants holding the United States hostages, who who were taken captive after the Shah was permitted to come to the United States for treatment at the request of David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger. These militants asked that the U.S. apologize for crimes against the Iranian people. I don't know if this would have been a good idea for Jimmy Carter to have done this. Track One diplomats or Track One leaders do that with some thoughtfulness. But surely, as thousands of Iranians have been tortured and killed by the U.S.-backed regime of the Shah, this request should not have been dismissed out of hand. Certainly, we can question deeply the decency of letting the desire for oil of the Western nations dominate our policy, risking global nuclear war to protect the flow of supplies in the Middle East. Remember that the U.S., with less than 5% of the world's population, consumes 40% of its resources. Perhaps we should apologize for aiding or having been willing to aid both Iraq and Iran in the Gulf War, as revealed in the exposure of the Iran-Contra scandal. Perhaps we should apologize to Arabs and Muslims for our tendency to look down, to dehumanize them, to dismiss their political struggles, to see them too readily as fanatics or terrorists without troubling to learn the sources of political unrest in the region. When we turn again to the Arab-Israeli conflict, we know now that many Israelis and Jewish Americans, though resolute about Israeli security, are troubled about the brutal turn of Israeli policy. The Physicians for Human Rights report included this almost passing sentence: "The uprisings are causing fear among Israelis, threatening a comfortable sense of domination of Palestinians that has been the bulwark of many Israelis, awakening echoes of terrorist assaults in others, and increasing the ambivalence about the future of the West Bank and Gaza in many." Many American Jews are troubled about the one-sidedness of a U.S. policy in which huge sums of money are given to the Israeli government with few questions asked, especially about the cost in Palestinian lives. We can commit ourselves to a just, even-handed policy in the region, which recognizes the basic rights and national aspirations of both peoples. In Israel, leading citizens are calling for U.S. pressure on their own government. A journalist, Gideon Samet, in the Israeli daily Haaretz, wrote this: "I don't care if it's the devil himself who brings about negotiations for a settlement, where the alternative is to submit to the far worse dictates of settlers and the sundry nationalist, messianic, evangelical rejectionists who are pushing us toward a dead end in a country that will continue to send its sons to beat people with clubs, to blow up ships in foreign harbors, and then ceaselessly explain to us that peace hasn't got a chance because of the villainous nature of the Arabs. It is against the backdrop of such a future mapped out for us by politicians who are blocking any movement that I hereby declare my readiness to welcome American pressure as a fresh morning breeze." Turning back to T. Lawrence, I find renewed meaning in his conflicts, renewed importance in his exaggerated assumption of responsibility, his struggle, his self-questioning, has a great value for us now. Mrs. Stuart Erskine spoke with Faisal in the early 1930s about Lawrence. Faisal didn't have an awful lot to say about Lawrence, but this is what he said to her. "Lawrence said many things about me which are not a bit true, and I should probably say things about him which would not be true either. He was a genius, of course, but not for this age. For a past age," she suggested, "on the contrary, for the future, 100 years hence, perhaps 200 years hence, he might be understood, but not today." Well, that was less than 60 years ago. Irving Howe, in his essay, The Problem of Heroism, said of Lawrence, "What finally draws one to him, making him seem not merely an exceptional figure, but a representative man of our century, is his courage and vulnerability in bearing the burden of consciousness." The title of my book, A Prince of Our Disorder, comes from Irving Howe. It refers to our psychological and moral disorder, especially in relation to the Middle East conflict. I will leave the last words in this talk to the famous Israeli novelist and essayist Amos Oz, and to Lawrence himself. In 1967, after the Six-Day War, Oz said the following words, which were reprinted in January 1988 in the Israeli monthly New Outlook on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the establishment of the Jewish state. Oz wrote, "I believe in a Zionism that accepts both the spiritual implications and the political consequences of the fact this small but precious land is the homeland of two peoples fated to live facing each other, because no God and no angel will come down to judge between right and right. The lives of both, the lives of all of us, depend on the hard, tortuous, and essential process of learning to know each other in this strife-torn landscape of this beloved country." Lawrence, in an introduction to Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which he suppressed because it wasn't yet the right time for it, wrote these following words, which contain an expression of his characteristic self-consciousness and egoism. They also reflect his rootedness in his own time, but they also contain his vision of possibility for a future not yet realized. "If I have restored to the East some self-respect, a goal, if I have made the standard of rule of white over red more exigent, I have fitted those people in a degree for the new commonwealth in which the dominant races will forget their brute achievements, and white and red and yellow and brown and black will stand up together without side glances in the service of the world." Thank you.
Dr. Mack, I think those of us who are familiar with this, the background of what you have to say, are very impressed with the force with which you said it and the significance. This is a seminal address, and we appreciate being here to hear it. In one way, I would like for us to close on this high note for the evening, but I think it's too rare an opportunity to ask Dr. Mack a few questions.
In holding up Lawrence as a paradigmatic example that we might follow, would you say that it would be perhaps a useful device to borrow some of the language of process conflict resolution to say that Lawrence perhaps is an example of a change agent, and focusing on the process of resolution of conflict rather than the issues that seek to divide, to build for mutually winnable solutions, and that each one of us could both draw from Lawrence's example and that of the current state of modern social science to apply these techniques? Is that a fair conclusion?
Great. Thank you very much. Couldn't have said it better.
I couldn't agree with you more. Name the Lawrence. Where is he?
Each one of us. I think that was the point. Was it not?
Exactly. Each of us. There's something of that in... See, one of the things about Lawrence, you weren't all at the symposium today, but I think that what draws people to Lawrence is that Lawrence is a kind of a holograph. You know what a holograph is? It's where you take any piece of it and you've got the whole thing. Well, when you study Lawrence, everybody finds something of themselves in Lawrence, some part of themselves, whether it's the part that would be hurting in some way over a conflict of some terrible frustration, or whether it would be that part of him that represents the possibility of a new kind of world, a different vision. I mean, There is something about him that we each find some, if it's his, or it's his shyness, or if it's his puckish sense of humor, but each of us somehow finds something of ourselves in his complex, protean identity. We all find a piece of ourselves in him, and that's the piece that I found in him. Others find something else. But I think it's an important, for me at least, it's an important part of what he represented.